is Transistor Radio, the weekly webcast of Transistor at 5045 North Clark Street. This is the Roundtable, and I'm Ronnie Wilpert. This week we have three guests. First, we have Joe Wallace of Turntabling.net in Paisley, Babylon. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi. So this week, Friday, you will be performing here at Transistor for a show at 8 o'clock. It's BYOB, and it's the 15th. And you'll be performing as Paisley Babylon, and I understand that you've got five turntables. Can you tell us what you'll have with you and what people can expect from the show?
It's a little crazy. You know, when I started thinking about the five turntables and five echo boxes and huge crates of vinyl and things like that, I wasn't really thinking about Christian Marclay, but it turns out that, you know, here's somebody who kind of pioneered all that I knew very little about. And so to kind of compare myself to him isn't good, but it's along those same lines, you know, doing crazy things with other people's recordings and your own recordings too. And it's mostly vinyl. There are some CDs thrown in there, you know, for fun and to make life easier on me, but it's a very vinyl-oriented performance, and it's designed for short attention spans, you know. My whole idea was I wanted it to kind of go the way those crazy dreams you have go, where one minute you're doing one thing, and then the next minute you're off, you know, 500 miles away doing something else. And
I had a dream like that last night.
Exactly. It's chaotic and crazy, and, you know, it's soft and mellow one second, and then it's angry and noisy and crazy the next, and it just goes in 100 different directions depending on, you know, what the mood is.
So you've got five crates of vinyl. So what are the genres that you're spinning from?
My musical background's a little weird. So, you know, I kind of start off with, like, thinking about Brian Eno and Throbbing Gristle, but then there's these Italian horror movie soundtracks, you know, mm-hmm. So it's Goblin and Ennio Morricone, and, you know, I like to throw in some Chicago industrial in there. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, this is the old home of Wax Tracks, you know, So you got to throw in some Gary Clale and, yeah. You know, some of that old crazy aggressive stuff. But then, you know, settling, I like to throw in things that people have heard of. You know, you can't really go completely out in left field obscure. You got to give people something to hang on to and go, what was that? So you'll hear some disco creeping its way in there. You know, you might hear some Isaac Hayes, you know, mashed up with Ennio Morricone.
That's what I was going to ask. Are you playing full songs, or a piece of something and then you'll go into something else? And is it pretty organic as you're working and spontaneous?
Yeah. It all started with this weird accident back in, it was like 97, and I was doing some, again, it was basically the same thing I'm doing now, except I was just fiddling around with things. I didn't really set out to create these weird hybrid recordings, but I was playing around with an Aphex Twin record, and I threw some Ravi Shankar sitar music over the top of it, and they blended so seamlessly that I thought, you know, this is insane, and it was an accident, but you could recreate those kinds of happy accidents if you really, you know, put your mind to it. And just finding the right combination of weirdness to collide.
Wow. So, but you've also got the beats per minute that need to match up and everything too. So does that matter, or do you have to use equipment to change that, or doesn't it matter?
I don't really pay attention to that stuff. You know, when I started collaborating with other people, and they'd say, well, send me your tracks with the BPMs listed out. And it's like, I don't work that way. That's math. Math is hard. That's not me. So what I do is I just put something on, and it is kind of a series of happy train wrecks, but I don't try and do the math and try and beat match and things like that. It's like, you know, if Isaac Hayes is on there, then, you know, there's something else that will
collide
with that.
At this point, you know your collection well enough, or you just kind of intuitively can say, I know this is going to work well with this.
Yeah. Well, there's this one record that's kind of a crutch record for me. It's a Sly and Robbie record. And there's this one track called Computer Malfunction. And it's like, I know that anything I put up against that will sound great. So it's like, I've got like five or six of these things. It's like when things start going wrong, I fall back on the ones I know really well. And it's like, well, that Sly and Robbie record is just perfect for throwing this weird Ennio Morricone soundtrack over the top of. And then throwing, like, I've got this big collection of weirdness on vinyl, like Army Boot Camp recordings, and there's a Kojak record, and Roddy McDowell reading H.P. Lovecraft, just all this weirdness, you know.
I cannot wait. I am so thrilled. It's going to be so much fun. Man, I can't wait. So What is an echo machine or echo box exactly?
I use guitar effects processors. I use the cheapest ones I could find.
It's an echo.
Yeah, basically. Okay, yeah. There's this company called Behringer, and I bought like three of these Behringer pedals, and they're basically carbon copy knockoffs of other equipment. And you know, they're all made in China in some factory in the middle of nowhere, and it's perfect for what I want. Cheap and nasty, you know. And so you hook up turntables to these echo machines and just let things get crazy and twiddle with the knobs and, you know, just it kind of spins itself into this lather.
So you've been doing this since 87, and you have also a blog called turntabling.net, and you do a road tour, which I think you've done one or two, and you're getting ready to do another one. And how does this all mix together, say, in your own schedule, or what came first? Was it the DJing that came first, and then?
Well, the DJing came first. I started off in 87. I shudder to say this. My first DJ gig was the overnight shift at a soft rock station in Springfield, Illinois. And I was pulling Midnight to Six, playing Dan Fogelberg and Barbara Streisand and Don Johnson duets. Just this horrible, horrible music that's bad for you and probably causes cancer. Yeah. And from there, I went into more DJ stuff. I got into Armed Forces Radio when I joined the Air Force and had a weird career doing that. And this whole genesis of what I'm doing now sort of started on the air, believe it or not, on military radio, because we would be bored on these late night shifts and I'd start putting these things together. And it's like, there's something to this. This is kind of weird, I'm doing without a net. But when I started collecting vinyl, I started in Texas, which is really just this repository for all kinds of weird stuff. And, you find all these albums that nobody else seems to want. And then, you come up here and it's like everybody has already collected those records. But they're just these abandoned, the orphan records, And when I started collecting in Texas and started playing around with vinyl, it becomes an obsession if you're prone to that sort of collector mentality, which apparently I am. And when I got up here and started the turntabling blog, I thought, I really should start seriously collecting again. Mm. And then I thought, it would really be great if there was a guide to the record stores that you can find, as you go traveling. And I thought, nobody else is doing it. So I put together this thing, and it was called Vinyl Road Rage. And I drove back to see my friends in Texas. So I just decided to stop along the way in places like St. Louis and Springfield, Missouri, and Oklahoma City and Denton, Texas, and Dallas and Austin, which is really a vinyl mecca. Austin is just this amazing place to find great records and weird stuff on vinyl. And it just kind of exploded. People were really interested in that, apparently. And I thought,
when was that?
Was that?
When was that you did that first?
Was last year. Okay. And I did another one this year from here to New York. And it was about the same. It was the same level of interest. And I thought, I guess I better do a third one.
Was that when you also stepped into Transistor? And did you come in here as part of that tour?
Yes, actually, because I was trying to figure out a time to get away and do the drive. And I thought, I can just do stuff in the local area in the meantime and just kind of do one or two a week. And so I came in here and wrote up Transistor. And there were a few other places that I've hit out in the burbs and, on the way to my old hometown in Springfield. And
have you thought about putting this together in a book?
I have. I don't think I've got enough yet. There are many, many, many more cities and record stores to hit, but it would be a hell of a project.
It really would. And maybe there's others out there that have done something. You would know at this point if there's others that have maybe done something like this, and maybe people could work together or something.
It's funny. It seems like there are regional guides. People kind of cover their own area. But I don't really see much of the let's get in the car and go and do this insane sort of road trip from point A to point. The ultimate for me would be to start in New York and wind up in California. But that is, that's a commitment.
Well, and are you also working in video? Or this week will you have some video projection at your show here?
Yes, I put together something. I actually debuted an early form of it at the Music Box just to see what people would think. And I put together this weird collage of all these different strange, just like what the hell moments from movies, a lot of Italian horror and French and Spanish stuff. And people, I think, were paying more attention to the video at first than they were to the set because it was the Music Box Massacre and it was a horror movie related thing. So I'm still tweaking with that a little bit, but yes, there will be this short attention span eyeball barrage going on while the vinyl is spinning itself into weird things.
You also make your own music, and you brought in some CDs tonight, the Alpha Wave Variations.
Yes.
So what are you using to create your music?
For that one, I have a great big pile of old analog keyboards, a Juno series from Roland, like Juno 6 and Juno 1, and there's a Korg O1W in there, and I just I did a lot of these weird late night sort of sleep deprived recordings. I wanted to get into this weird sort of headspace. You know, being in the military, I obviously wasn't sampling any recreational chemicals, so sleep deprivation and caffeine were my drugs of choice, you know. And when I recorded that stuff, there was a lot of these weird 3 a.m. sessions where I would just get these keyboards running, and there were some loops, and I had a pile of toy keyboards that I ran through echo machines. The echo machines, for some reason, are just this big part of, like, the central theme of mine. I don't know why, but at the time that I was recording that stuff, I was really watching a lot of European cinema, a lot of weird, you know, Italian horror films and thrillers and things like that. And so these bizarre, creepy soundtrack sounds were going through my head, and that kind of found its way onto this recording.
And then your music also finds its way into your DJ sets as
yes.
well. So people are hearing things that they've not heard anywhere else.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I may as well. Nobody else is playing this, you know, on the air anywhere, so I got to slip it in there somehow. And so, yeah, I like to throw it in there from time to time just to wake people up a little bit. And some of it's kind of abrasive, and some of it's kind of Eno-esque. So it kind of runs the course.
This is the Roundtable with Ronnie Wolpert. I've been speaking with Joe Wallace of Paisley Babylon and also turntabling.net. One more question, Joe. On your Road Rage vinyl Road Rage, can you tell me about maybe one of the more unique stores or record shops that you found during your travels?
You know, it's interesting. The most unique one, the one that I like the best, this insane, gigantic warehouse of a shop called Jerry's Records in Pittsburgh. And Jerry's Records was built on the second floor of what used to be a car showroom. So, I mean, this guy has just insane amounts of vinyl. And the only way that this store can structurally support all of this weight is because it's built on steel that was used to make sure these cars didn't fall through the floor. And I'm talking to the guy, and it's so huge, it's actually intimidating. It's very difficult to shop in there the first time because you don't know where to start.
And is it categorized, labels, the sort of thing?
It's one of the most exhaustively cataloged and well-labeled stores I have ever been in. Imagine a store the size of Transistor that's dedicated to soundtracks.
Yeah.
That's one room in this place. Huh. And I'm talking to this guy, and he goes, yeah, you know, my air conditioning bills here are $1,300 a month. And, you know, you're looking at the post-punk section all by itself is just this endless mile-long row. And again, very anal-retentively organized. Mm-hmm. It's adamant and, you know, I mean, it starts with A
yeah.
and all these band names. I mean, the Skids and Bauhaus and Tones on Tail. And those are just the ones that you know.
Yeah.
You know, then there's five other ones behind Tones on Tail you've never heard of. I mean, some people, okay, I know a lot of people have probably heard of Tuxedo Moon, but, you know, if that's a little obscure for you, you know, you've got five more T's to get through before you even find something that you recognize.
Wow.
You know, so it was just, I stuck to post-punk and weird records because that's all my poor little shattered brain could handle.
That's great. What was that place called again?
Jerry's Records.
Jerry's Records, okay.
An institution down there.
Well, Joe, we're really looking forward to your show. Again, that's this Friday, the 15th. It's at 8 o'clock. It's BYOB, $5 suggested donation. And Joe Wallace, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
At last, the innocent have finally slaughtered the innocent.
is the Roundtable with Ronnie Wilpert, and our next guest today is Damon Locks, visual artist and musician. Hey, Damon.
Hello, Ronnie. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for coming on the show.
The table is less round than I expected.
I know. That's our regular joke, is the round table on a square / rectangular table.
I do like the hover chair I'm sitting in.
Ooh. I like the color, aqua. So, Damon, you are the newest artist to come in here into Transistor, but you're actually the first artist whose work we're featuring that's really a combination of media, but especially involves illustration, printmaking, and more of a fine art aspect in addition to photography. So we're very excited to have your work here, and first just want to thank you for being here.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
So we hung the work the last few days, and the visual art that you're doing, we have digital prints here, which are a combination of printmaking, silkscreening, and can you tell us about what the pieces do contain and how they're put together?
Well, that's a difficult question.
I thought you could probably say it better than I could.
Yeah, well, the pieces that are here are a combination of a couple different approaches. There are some that are kind of landscape-oriented that are rely heavily on photo collage and manipulation, and then they're digitally printed out. And those kind of center around cities and urban environments, and somehow they're distorted, and some of them are distorted and kind of off-kilter, and some of them are just variations of reality, you know? And then there's some pieces that are more black and white oriented, and those have a tendency of being more illustrative, and with a little bit of collage. So I feel like what happens quite often, which is not a rule by any stretch of the imagination, but pieces that focus on figures as the main characters of the images tend to be black and white, and then images that focus on landscapes tend to be color. There's no rule about that. It's just something after I looked at, like, 2 years, 3 years worth of stuff, I noticed.
Realized that. Yeah, you have that consistency. So people have looked at your work, and first they think the pieces that are here that are like more photo collage, although they have these other elements too, they think that the scene is real, and they realize, wait, it's not quite real because it's manipulated. But it kind of reminded me a little bit of architectural renderings where people, photographs of people will be put into the place, and they kind of look like they are there, but they're not there because they're more flat than the scene would have. So it's a really kind of... it's kind of a strange way to perceive reality, which is really neat, kind of catches people off guard. But are all these photos your own photos?
Yes.
Including the people?
Yeah. I try to take, that's kind of a rule I have. I think I broke the rule once with my mom. There was an image of my mom from like 1972. I didn't take that photograph, but all the other images I take, yeah.
And so...
I really never cottoned to the age of appropriation. Like that didn't really sit well with me, so I wanted to produce my own stuff.
I agree with that, actually. Yeah, I mean, and actually that's one thing I love about your work is that it is all these different media, and it's all coming together, but it's all yours. And so in addition to the photography, there's the printmaking, and then there's this this texture to it. It's kind of a little bit grunged or a little noisy and that sort of thing.
Distressed and noisy, yeah.
Yeah, which kind of gives it antique or something. It gives it an older quality. So it's not like how somebody might do a photo illustration, but it's really clean and in that regard. It doesn't really interest me. But in the way that you're doing the work, it's so real and so interesting. So what's the process for adding that texture into those?
I like noise. I like a lot of visual noise, and it's a variety. It's both. It's like photographic as well as just stuff I do. For some reason, for example, I have a whole catalog of textures. So I take my digital camera around, and if I see a piece of cement that looks cool, I'll take a picture of it, or a wall and what have you, because I was always, as a kid, intrigued with graffiti or just degenerating walls, and I always liked when there were tons of flyers and posters up, and pulled down. I lived in New York in the 80s. I used to just love those images. So I think that that's kind of what I'm inserting. I'm inserting layers of noise. And when I do that, I feel like it actually makes the images somehow look more realistic to me.
More like
and,
life.
Yeah, and I don't know what that means, but I might put something together, and when I start putting the layers of visual noise, it seems more real to me. It seems like it's coming to life that way. So
I agree.
That's why I do it. It's just intuitive.
Do you have some images that are as old as from the 80s that you're bringing in now, or even just the textures?
No. I just realized, like, as I saw the kind of as I built kind of this world of imagery, I started to think about where they came from. You know, I've done some artist talks, so when I have to talk to people about my work, I often go back to, like, as being a teenager and listening to music and looking at flyers, and, you know, all that stuff is stuff that I still carry with me and still kind of appears.
And you are a musician as well. You're in the band The Eternals and in another band
as
well?
Yeah, the Exploding Star Orchestra. Yeah.
And what is your role in those bands?
I'm a vocalist for both of them. The Eternals is has been me and Wayne Montana for the last, since 1997, I think. And we've had different drummers throughout them. But I'm the vocalist for that group, as well as I play synthesizer and samples and that sort of thing. And then the Exploding Star Orchestra is a Rob Mazurek project, who is a cornet player, and I'm the vocalist for that. But there's, like, you know, as few as 8 people and as many as, like, 14 people in that group.
Are you involved in creating visuals for those bands, too?
Well, I do, like, I just did the Exploding Star Orchestra album cover, and I do all the Eternals art, you know, as well. But we might have some projection in Brazil when we go, which will probably be my art.
And you've traveled to Brazil and other places as a musician and taken photos there, is that
correct?
Yeah.
There's actually some of the pieces that are here are made up of images from Sao Paulo, Brazil.
How extensive is your photo image library?
Well, since it's on hard drives, it's hard to it's hard to know, and they're all in different folders, so I don't know how many I have. You know, it's you just kind of get to know them as you click through them, and you go, oh wait, that's in this folder. So I actually have no earthly idea.
So at one time, were you working in more of a traditional printmaking technique as well, like just only silkscreen or only woodblock or something?
Oh, I was doing a lot of linoleum cutting and relief printing, which was kind of I really took to in school, and for a while I wasn't focusing on my visual art as a craft, and I wasn't focusing on visual art for myself. I was doing illustration work, and I kind of the relief print or the linoleum cut became kind of my signature. So people would be like, oh, can you do that, you know, linoleum cut style that you do, you know? So that was something that was everyone knew me for a while. But then I started doing, like, ink drawings with bamboo sticks, and they looked just like my linoleum cuts, so people didn't know the difference. So linoleum cuts, relief printing I haven't done in a while, but I started incorporating screen printing because I feel like my ink drawings work in the same visual way as my linoleum cuts to me, so it's a little easier.
What's your education background?
I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts at the Art Institute.
And you also studied at the School of Visual Arts in New York?
Yeah, School of Visual Arts. Yeah, I went there for 2 years, yeah.
Was that for printmaking?
No, I was a fine arts major then. No, I was an illustration major then, and I took 2 years there and then transferred here.
So you have your work here. Are there other places that are permanently exhibiting your work, or do you have some work that is in transport?
This is the only place that you can walk in and see my work other than my house. But you can't just walk in there. But you can if you know me. But
I'm coming over.
I have some work up this weekend in a show in New York called Reform Schools. And that's only up for like 3 days. And I've had other pieces and shows and stuff, but this is the only place that they remain on the wall for longer period of time.
So thematically, your pieces do tend to seem to be about maybe, you've mentioned education, but youth, I've seen a lot of images of younger people, and, and then there's the urban environment too. And do you have sort of a, in your artist statement, since as you said, you probably have put that out there before, do you have a certain thematic point? Is education important as part of your, the message?
Yeah, I think that it is important, but it's just a part of many things that I find important. You know, I'm kind of interested in, you know, I've become interested in, you know, community and society as a whole. And so I've kind of like created work that to me talks about whatever my inner dialogue is or issues that need to be like addressed, you know? And I think about who's seeing it and what kind of images I'm putting out there, you know? So there's subject matter that I see that doesn't get addressed in the arts currently, so and they're close to me, so I kind of address things that I'm interested in. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, and you also have a blog, The Population.
I have a blog called The Population.
So maybe that's another medium that where some of those other interests find themselves.
Yes. I try to balance things that kind of sit that work for the medium, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that education is one thing that I address, but there's a wide array of things that can be addressed that are addressed in my art, and just sometimes things pop out, you know.
Well, when you mentioned that, looking at your work as a whole after a time, that then you see that, and I've done that before too. I don't often realize even what my own language is as an artist until I put everything out there and I say, hey, I'm realizing this is repeating itself or this is repeating itself. It's a really neat process
artist. That happens also as a vocalist or a lyric writer for myself. Sometimes I'll write a song and then it won't be until after I'm done the song that I figure out what it's about or what I was talking about.
Yeah. And in the 90s, you were in another band.
I was in a band called Trench Mouth in the 90s, yes.
And they got pretty well known?
They got more well known after we broke up, actually. That's how life is. You know, mm-hmm. we got more of a reputation or what have you. People cared more after we broke up, I felt like, yeah. Mm.
So,
we had a very loyal fan base. But then after we broke up, it became more legendary, I guess.
Ah. What would you say your sort of half visual art, half music as the way that you live your life, or is there one that sort of has a greater focus for you?
Well, I don't think I look at it that way. I feel like art is just a feeling or an urge, and it depends on what medium. Mm-hmm. So music is a medium, visual art is a medium, you know.
I feel the same.
Yeah, ink drawing is a medium, silk screen is a medium, mm-hmm. you know.
It kind of feels like what's right at that time.
Right, exactly.
So where can people find out more about you online?
I guess The Population, which is thepopulation@wordpress.com. I guess there is, what else is out there?
Do you have a website, DamonLox.com?
Yes, DamonLox.com/art.
Okay.
I think that's my art website. Yeah.
Good.
That's it.
Okay, and I wanted to ask too, is the Eternals playing anywhere soon that people could catch you?
We're playing at the Whistler on the 18th.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, Damon, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. I will see you all soon. Oh, wait, don't we have something coming up here?
Okay.
Goodbye. It's nice talking to you.
No, come back. So we also will have an opening reception for your work, although it's already hung, but a party here on the 16th, which is next Saturday, which will be a reception for you, and we're really looking forward to that, too.
That should be awesome. I'm very excited about it.
Great. Okay, so Damon.
DJ Major Taylor is going to be DJing that, I think.
Yeah, so and as well, we'll have DJ Major Taylor, who is a close personal friend of yours and
that's
an amazing
correct,
DJ.
Yes. I know DJ Major Taylor.
Great. Can't wait.
Okay.
Thanks, Damon.
All right, bye.
This is The Roundtable with Ronnie Wilpert, and my next guest today is Eve Feynman, a furniture designer and interior architect. Have I said that right? Hi, Eve.
Yes, that was perfect.
Okay. Are you more of an architect or more of a furniture designer?
I'm a furniture designer that has not been able to stop doing architecture my whole life.
Huh. So you went to school for architecture?
I did. I got my undergraduate degree in architecture, just straight architecture, but I was always interested in furniture design and afraid of power tools.
Mm-hmm.
So I forced myself to take an independent study with a sculptor professor who knew his way around a shop pretty well and designed a really complicated piece of furniture that I struggled through building and thought that I would never touch a tool again.
Yeah.
And the second I was done, I was completely hooked and wanted to do another piece immediately.
Well, I will say that as women, that is unfortunately something we don't often think, well, we're just going to jump into getting onto the power sander or the actual saw that will cut through metal, that sort of thing with the sparks flying and everything.
Yeah.
But once you get past that, it's a whole other world.
It is another world, although there's a scale issue that I still have problems with, which I pretended like it didn't exist for a long time when I was working alongside men, and you know, they were either more familiar with the tools because they grew up using them,
right,
or just simply their size hands just makes it much easier to put pressure on something or drill through something or cut through something. And so, you know, in one of my other lives, I'd like to design a line of power tools for smaller people.
Cool. So what are the pieces that you're focusing on right now? We've seen some things online, and we've seen a bench and tables and this sort of thing. What is your line like?
It's in prototype right now, and the main focus is more about the concept behind the system as opposed to the individual pieces. So I was awarded a sabbatical from teaching about 2 years ago, and I started by posing the question to myself, how can I reconcile the need to reduce consumption as a society with the fact that I produce objects? Kind of a seeming paradox. And so I set out to try and resolve that by rethinking the whole idea of furniture design, not as single objects that are produced and bought and then eventually end up in a landfill, but a system of exchange and interchange where pieces and parts can be swapped out or melted down and reused without degrading in quality. And that, in theory, if I had a client that commissioned me to do and everything would be custom still, because all my pieces are custom and site-specific, I'm still very interested in the intersection of architecture and furniture. So how can I produce custom pieces that do this? It would have to be in the system itself. So, for example, if I had a client who commissioned me to do a big media wall and then they moved, they could return pieces of the component of the overall unit and then have other pieces made to fit a new space or a new function.
So are the materials consistent throughout? And I think you're working mostly with wood, is that correct?
I have four materials I'm using right now. Actually, I did a bunch of research on sustainable materials and have broken them into two categories based on a book called Cradle to Cradle. So they talk about recycling is actually not a good process in that the materials degrade over time, and coined a term upcycling, which has to do with materials that can be reused infinitely. And so I tried to use their model as a way of determining what materials I would use, and they break their materials into two categories, bionutrients and technonutrients. So bionutrients, in theory, are materials you could just drop on the ground and they would nourish the earth. They would biodegrade and become soil. Technonutrients are chemically processed or man-made materials, but they stay in production infinitely. So it's not like paper that when it gets recycled can't be paper again. It can be toilet paper and then eventually ends up in a landfill. The technonutrients are things like aluminum.
Metals.
Without additives, and this eco resin that I use that has a really beautiful quality to it, but also is strong enough in that any cutoffs can be sent back to the manufacturer and they can melt them down and make them into the same thing over and over again. The wood that I use is bamboo, which is a rapidly renewable resource and a bionutrient, and I don't use any glue in any of my pieces, and no chemical finishes. So those were the parameters for the system that became really challenging because the default is glue and finish and all kinds of other materials that don't fit.
especially when you think of furniture, because it's got to hold weight.
Right.
So, yeah, so what's the process for that? But you also, you went to the School of the Art Institute and studied interior architecture.
I did. So that was me trying to force myself a little bit out of just straight architecture and learn more about furniture design. And there was a professor there at the time, Tim Cousins, whose work I really liked. Mm. And I was fortunate enough to work to study under him and then be his TA, and then I've worked for him, and since he has built some stuff for me. But that was a better way of me exploring that middle ground between furniture and architecture.
I think that, first I want to say, if you could sort of describe what interior architecture is, because I don't think people understand that term, but also because you were there, I think, in the 90s, was that a newer department at the school at the time?
It might have been. It's now called Architecture, Interiors, and Designed Objects, which I kind of love.
AIDO?
I guess so, yeah. And so it was in transition to becoming the department that it is now. I think interior architecture isn't really an official discipline, but it's a term coined because there are a lot of misconceptions with the phrase interior design, and also because a lot of architectonics exist in the inside, interior space, and relate more to the human body. And so it's really, it's all the components of architecture just inside. So, you know, when people say interior design, a lot of times they think of, you know, curtains and pillows and carpets. And interior architecture is much more about form, space, architectonics, lighting,
structures,
material structure.
So could you share with us an example of a client's work that you've done? And especially, have you done an actual building structure and then these custom-designed furniture elements that go within it, so it's got this cohesive whole?
Yeah, the largest projects that I've done ground-up architecture have just been house additions. Mm. I've done a lot of interiors where I've incorporated custom furniture. So either way, it's either been a gut renovation where we've just stripped it down to the structure and then designed the whole interior space with custom millwork throughout. And then, you know, the additions to homes or sort of second halves of houses that we've built or that I've done in my various incarnations, always conceive of all these different scales of design. So I never think about the shell and then the interior partitions and then how do you furnish it, but almost
it's all a space.
It's all the same, and the partitions could also become storage or surface, and they delineate space and are functional. A lighting element might be architectural. It's not just here's the ceiling and I'm going to go pick out some fixtures.
And your work is, from what I've seen, it's got kind of a minimalist aesthetic, would you say, or is that too simple of a way to look at it?
This current line does in its current state. Definitely, I would say that I tend to focus on texture and material. I don't necessarily like to label myself in terms of an ism so much, but because my designs do respond to the space and sometimes that calls for more of a hybrid design approach of old and new. I do love old things too, so it's not just completely stripped down and bare. But it really is about celebrating the material. So in that way, I think sometimes it does seem sort of minimalist, but the materials themselves have a lot of depth and richness to them.
But with the design, if it's more simple, does that make it more modular as well?
I guess you could say that, yeah. I'm at the point where it's not quite modular, but the components, some of them are interchangeable. Right now, what I've done is come up with a system of connectors so that everything gets connected the same way by one universal connector that you can tighten with a quarter.
And that's something that you've created or invented?
Yeah.
Do you have a patent on that, or are you working toward that?
I don't. I'm considering it. I've thought about different potential avenues for getting the hardware produced, and I haven't quite settled on it yet. So I feel like, as usual, I'm sort of carving a whole new path that doesn't quite exist. I'm like in between traditional manufacturing and custom production, and so I'm trying to figure out.
And I also wrote down the word sculpture and wanted to ask you that. Do you ever think of your work as sculpture or in a sculptural way?
I never have. I've never considered myself a fine artist, but I do think of a lot of furniture as works of art in and of themselves. And so I guess there's that hybrid as well.
And you're teaching as well, right? Where do you teach?
I teach at the Illinois Institute of Art in Chicago, which is not the Art Institute, and it's not IIT. I've been there for full-time for about 8 years.
Mm. And you're specifically teaching architecture or furniture design? Or
both.
Okay.
I recently created a class called Interior Objects and Furniture for the school, and that was a kind of final component of my sabbatical, and that has been going really well. There's a lot of great work coming out of it, and the students are really excited to get their hands on materials and get a little dirty and messy.
Well, I remember as a grad student at the School of the Art Institute, sustainability was a really big word about 5 years ago, and I'm sure before, and even now. And so I know that there's this movement, and people are working in that way and everything, but it still seems like what you're doing, is that part of this larger movement, or is it still, because it seems like you've got a lot of innovations, and that also in being an instructor, you're sharing those innovations as much as you can anyway with others, so you're kind of maybe building this whole new
To. I mean, I tend to be a critical thinker, so where sustainability is now I don't think is nearly enough in that it's looking at individual parts and pieces. It's this material. It's this product. And even if it's a whole building, it's still parts and pieces. And so what I'm trying to do is conceive of a whole new way of thinking about owning and using objects.
Or as you said, a system?
So it's a system or a cycle, and it's not linear. And I do think good design is built into sustainability, because if you look at the Eames chair, for example, it won't end up in a landfill because people want it still. So in that way, just good design is sustainable.
And you also have a company called Space Lab, is that correct?
I did. I was partners with another architect for a while, and we collaborated on a lot of these similar kinds of projects that were architecture and furniture based. But then we split off, and he's doing more just architectural work. And my focus is really trying to force myself to just do furniture, which is what I kind of love the most. So,
if somebody wanted to hire you for a commission piece or to work with them to design a space, how would they get in touch with you?
They can go to my website, which is www.evefeinman.com. And they can contact me that way.
And I wanted to ask you about this term, planned obsolescence. And so, and you're, what you're doing is complete opposite of that. What is planned obsolescence?
Planned obsolescence was an intentional creation in the 50s for figuring out how product designers could get people to buy more stuff. So the idea was, okay, well, we shouldn't be designing things for life, because then we're only going to sell one transistor radio per person's lifetime. So planned obsolescence is the whole idea of built-in destruction, basically, of an object, so that it'll fail or break down or need to be completely replaced in a given amount of time. And there's been a lot of market research on what that time limit is, so that it's not too short that people will think it's cheap and they won't buy it in the first place, but it's just long enough so that they're ready to, they're okay to replace it. And it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So if you think about technology, if you think about telephones in the 70s, you had one in your house and it stayed there for 20 years. And the idea of having the same cell phone for 20 years is absurd. We can't do it. So technological advances also are planned obsolescence, with system software upgrades that you can barely even tell what's changed, but you have to pay to upgrade or pay to communicate with people with lower versions. I mean, it's all the business.
What's the name of your product line?
Interstice is the name of the product line. I've always been kind of obsessed with the concept of interstitial space, or spaces in between. The space between furniture and architecture, between furniture and the body. And so also it sort of all came together with this custom connector that I was talking about that connects all the pieces together, with a slot in the middle that is a space that also looks like an eye. So that became the logo, and it was just sort of one of those things where it all made sense. So in terms of the space between, with this line, it's also just kind of exploring uncharted territory.
And have you had, or are you looking for, interns, apprentices, people to help you in your own company?
I currently have a pretty good roster of students and former students who are extremely talented, who I love to be able to draw from whenever I need to. But I am also happy and love to collaborate. I collaborate with architects as well. So, yeah, I'm totally open to different types of collaboration, and hopefully we'll need people to work for me sometime in the future.
Great. This is the Roundtable with Ronnie Wilpert, and I've been speaking with Eve Feynman, who owns the company Interstice and is a faculty at the Illinois Institute of Art Chicago. Eve, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you for some reason.